The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform. You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 13th of October 2021 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Novartis. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, the European Union is getting ready to set out proposals to address the row with the UK about trade in Northern Ireland. We'll have the latest. Also ahead, Japan's ruling party makes an election pledge to increase the nation's defence spending. The move would mark a departure from the tradition of capping the country's outlay at just 1%. But will it actually happen? Plus,
we were commissioned for Stansted. He said, you know, I want a new generation airport. I want you to challenge everything. And we challenged everything.
We raid our archives to revisit an interview with legendary architect Lord Foster. And we'll make some time too before the end of the programme to check in with our culture editor reporting live from the Frieze Art Fair, just around the corner from Monocle HQ here in London. All that ahead here on The Briefing with me, Tom Edwards. The European Union is expected to set out proposals today to address the row with the UK about trade in Northern Ireland. UK Brexit Minister Lord Frost has demanded the current protocol, which was designed to avoid a hard border on the island of Ireland, be thrashed out. He claims the current arrangements are simply not working. Well, I'm joined on the line now by Stephanie Boltson, UK and Ireland correspondent for Die Welt. Good afternoon to you, Stephanie. Just remind us of the backdrop here, if you can summarise this succinctly, why the current protocol remains so unsatisfactory.
Well, yeah, it's a, I hear that in your a bit of a smiling voice, if I may say. It's a very complex issue. But the fact is that because of Brexit, Northern Ireland, so the British territory of Northern Ireland, is not Britain as such is not an EU member anymore, while the Republic of Ireland, of course, still is. And the Republic of Ireland is also still in the single market of the European Union. But because of obvious historic reasons, nobody wanted a new border on the island of Ireland. And therefore, exactly 2 years ago, Boris Johnson agreed to the so-called Northern Ireland Protocol, which means that since the 1st of January this year, there are controls for goods coming from Great Britain to Northern Ireland. And because the regime of the European Union is very strict, the standards are very high, especially when it comes to food and live animals and meat. I mean, we have been talking about the so-called war on sausages. There has been a lot of disruption in the trade between, which is basically one territory. So, for example, sausages coming from, say, Derbyshire to Derry or to Belfast, they were controlled. There's a lot of paperwork, a lot of burdens on both sides in Northern Ireland and in Great Britain. Shelves were at some point a bit more empty. It's very costly for people who trade. And therefore, the British government is saying this is not feasible. This is really putting the provisions and supply in Northern Ireland at risk. And we need to renegotiate that protocol.
Now, Stephanie, I'm sure I am not alone. I'm sure many listeners will say, oh, this is like that dreadful recurring nightmare where the endless Brexit negotiations drag on and on and on intractably. Interestingly here, though, both sides do seem to broadly agree that the protocol is posing difficulties and it is an inelegant solution. And yet one wonders, is it going to be that same old story that actually it's going to be the side that is less intractable that may yield and actually give some progress? Because, you know, unionists are very, very clear that any kind of trade border fundamentally undermines their place in the union, and they seem to be immovable on that front, don't they?
Yes, they are. And we have heard accordingly the demands from Stormont, from the DUP. They are saying if the protocol is not scrapped, then they would maybe even leave the executive. I mean, there is very radical demands coming from the unionist side. I mean, to be fair, the European Commission has admitted that there are really problems on the ground. And that's why today they are presenting quite a large and I think quite very far-reaching proposals to mitigate the problems. The EU Commission had lots of people on the ground in the last 4 weeks. They talked to all the stakeholders, they've talked to business, they talked to politicians, civil society, to find out what are the problems. They admit there are problems and they want to mitigate them. But they will not change the fundamental approach, which is Britain has decided, or the majority of British voters in 2016 decided to leave the European Union and therefore the single market. Northern Ireland was always to be the biggest challenge. It's actually something, it's a conundrum you can't really solve. They found this compromise and Britain has signed it. Boris Johnson signed it. He negotiated it with the Irish Prime Minister and with the Commission. And now 2 years later, they are suddenly saying we're not interested anymore. And not only that they say there are problems on the ground, they are putting additional demands on top, which is, and this is now the big elephant in the room, that the European Court of Justice must not be have any say in any disputes in Northern Ireland.
Mm. Well, as you say, it's an intractable problem. There are, I don't know, can you have several elephants in the room? That seems to be just one. Given that then, Stephanie, how do these talks play out? Presumably they take some time. I mean, is there any real optimism or expectation on either side that genuine progress can be achieved here?
I mean, I've been talking a lot to people in Brussels and in Berlin the last days. And what is going to happen is it's going to be, again, the European Commission is very unemotional, pragmatic. They're going to present these proposals today, 6:30 in the evening, Brussels time. And then they say they will actually already they have people on the train to London. They want to work with their British counterparts and go through all these points and find common ground. And then obviously the Europeans are very happy to move and they have a knowledge that in some senses they have been too strict. But the question is at the end of the day, a political. So does Lord Frost, and I'm sure you reported on his speech yesterday in Lisbon, and where he insisted again that the European Court of Justice must not have any say. If it's more a political game and the British government insists that the Europeans will have to move there, then we are really in a cul-de-sac, because that's very difficult. The Europeans can legally not move on this. So there's the threat in the room by the Brits to say we will trigger the so-called Article 16, which in effect would lift, or would actually, how do you say, the Northern Ireland Protocol would not be implemented anymore. Mm. And the consequences of that you need control somewhere else. And then you either have a border on the land, which everybody wanted, was desperate to avoid, or you cut off Ireland from the single market and you need to control goods coming from the EU member island into EU member states being all together in the single market. And that, of course, for Ireland is the worst case. Well, one of the worst cases.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, Stephanie, as a final short answer, whether you thought it was actually whether we would get a resolution. But I sense from that picture you've painted that I think we have to play a waiting game and keep watching. It seems unlikely. Is that fair enough?
I think we, let's talk again in 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, you're booked in, Stephanie Boltson. We'll talk to you then. That was our Stephanie Boltson, bringing us up to speed on those EU proposals. Now, let's cross and hear from Monocle's Paige Reynolds. She's standing by with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Tom. More than 100 countries have pledged to make the protection of wildlife habitats a central consideration in their policy making. The declaration on biodiversity was made at a summit in the Chinese city of Kunming and comes just a few weeks before the COP26 summit on climate change in Glasgow. The United States says it plans to open its land border with Mexico and Canada to vaccinated foreign nationals starting in early November. It would mark the first time the border has been opened to foreigners since the start of the coronavirus pandemic. The European Union is announcing a package of measures today to ease the impact of surging energy prices across the bloc. The goal is to coordinate gas purchases to boost supplies and to provide financial relief for poorer consumers ahead of the winter. And in Hong Kong, a sculpture to commemorate the 1989 Tiananmen Square protests faces a deadline of today to be removed from the University of Hong Kong's campus. The Danish artist Jens Galschut, who created the statue, is challenging the move. You can find out more by heading over to monocle.com/minute. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Tom.
Thank you very much, Paige. In Japan, the ruling party has made an election pledge to double the country's defence spending. The Liberal Democratic Party said its goal is to increase spending to 2% of GDP in order to counter threats from China and North Korea. The increase would mark a departure from Japan's political tradition of capping defence spending below 1% of its GDP. Well, for more on this, we're joined now by Alessio Patilano, professor at King's College London, an expert on Asian defence and a regular contributor to this programme. Good afternoon to you, Alessio. Let's start off with the background to this principle about Japanese military spending capped under 1%. This is a really important tradition, isn't it, in terms of how the political establishment deals with military spending.
Tom, delighted to join you today, as always. That's a very important point to start off with, because yes, it is symbolically and substantially always been quite important in political terms for prime ministers, consecutive prime ministers, to pledge the defence would be capped. But this is something that was a government decision in the first place. So the second point to make here is that the reasoning behind having this 1% was a specific interpretation that in the late 1970s and early 1980s, Japanese prime ministers provided as a way to pledge the country's defence posture remaining predominantly oriented, sort of in an exclusively defense-oriented fashion. So the interesting question here is that, yes, the 1% has been politically important in the past. Yes, it's been there for a long time, but also it's always been a political choice. So today what we're looking at is a government rethinking the general context within which that original pledge was placed and saying, maybe time has come to change that.
Well, Alessio, I guess that prompts me to ask you about the current political backdrop then, because obviously we have a new prime minister in Fumio Kishida who maybe is making the right noises, but I guess the practicalities, as ever, are shaped by various historical factors. Currently shaped, what, a debt-saddled public finance in Japan, and of course an economy that's been hit hard by the pandemic. Does that reality mean, actually, regardless of what Kishida says or indicates, it's unlikely that any doubling will happen, certainly imminently?
Well, Tom, I mean, this is you're hitting really at the heart of the question. And the answer to this, to this problem is divided into two main, if you want, points. On one hand, it should be said that depends on how you calculate, even to the current levels, Japanese defense budget, if you calculate it through NATO standards, for example, it would be in between 1.4 and 1.7% of GDP. So that places this pledge in a slightly different place, because they actually pledged to raise it to 2%. Now, depending on how you do the calculation, that can mean like investing a lot more, or indeed not so much more, but actually investing just about what you need to start delivering on the beefing up of capabilities that in Japan at the moment are relatively thin on the ground, whether it is long-range missiles, whether it is cyber and space. Again, part of the question is, when we look deep into the details, what that 2% actually means, because it could be a long way off and therefore not particularly likely to happen, given what you said, or indeed not that far away off. So that's one element of the conversation. The second element of the conversation is very much how the pledge works in relation to the upcoming elections and how Kishida is starting to present the LDP in a particular political space, one in which there has been a shift in public perception over the nature of regional security challenges, particularly insofar as China and North Korea is concerned. So I think the pledge sort of is trying to cater towards that particular type of shifting of public opinion on matters on security and defense. However, on this particular aspect, you are absolutely right. The Japanese economy is not coming off in tip-top shape, given the pandemic, given the fact that you've had the Olympic Games that could not deliver, for obvious reasons, the type of economic dynamism that bringing Olympic Games usually sort of provides. And as a result of that, you've got this incredible debt, and you've got a situation in which this pledge sounds like relatively difficult to be delivered on. So it's going to be really interesting to say and to explore how, with the coming up of the election, Kishida is trying to position the LDP in a certain political space, and how, in turn, that will play with having to play with the numbers on what exactly this 2% means.
Well, Alessio, given that very complicated backdrop, which you've unpacked, I think, very skillfully for us, given the complexity, if we just sort of set that to one side and look forward, do we have a sense of what the demands of the Japanese military specifically are? Are they calling for increased funding? Do we know, in point of fact, how additional funds would be spent? It's always, in some ways, more interesting to look at the sort of procurement side of this. But do we know what would happen to the money if, even given all of that complexity, we did see an increase in the budget?
So I think we are to expect, we should expect an increase in the budget. That's for sure. And again, as I say, playing with the numbers would mean that this 2% can be reached even without an actual doubling of the current budget. And you could see this in different forms. Priority, of course, have been already set. We've got the development of space and cyber capabilities with forces that should be sort of capable of manning and delivering on that side of the spectrum. And that is going to be quite important in the part of investment. And then, of course, you've got the additional capabilities, predominantly land-based long-range missiles, and if you want, the command and control functions that go with that. And of course, next-generation fighter jets and the sort of programs that are likely to see, and this is a really important point for us, a space to watch, as it were, is this question of how Japan has started to make the first openings towards increasing joining international corporations over defense equipment. So we might see a very interesting space evolving in terms of how Japan starts to taking its first steps into becoming a country that also produce jointly with others advanced military equipment. And therefore, defense is not just a drag on the overall economy, as it were, but it also becomes a first sort of space where defense experts, for example, looking down the road, might have some sort of returns on the investments that we are likely to see in the near future.
Alessio Patalano, always good to hear from you. Thanks for joining us here on the programme. You're with The Briefing on Monocle 24. We'll be hearing from Lord Foster right after this.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine. The global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine, Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. Today, the company is working on breakthrough treatments that push the boundaries of human understanding in biology, data science, and engineering, to develop and deliver therapies that help people live longer and healthier lives around the world. Novartis, reimagining medicine.
You're back with The Briefing here on Monocle 24. Now, all this week, we're playing some of our highlights from 10 years on air here at the station. Our next instalment is from back in 2015. That's when Norman Foster joined our editorial director, Tyler Brulé, to talk urban planning, big thinking, emerging economies, and how to design the perfect airport. All of that on the big interview. Let's take a listen.
You have Norman Payne, who was the head of British Airports Authority, an engineer. At the point that we were commissioned for Stansted, He said, you know, I want a new generation airport. I want you to challenge everything. And we challenged everything. And we turned the conventional model of an airport literally upside down. Every airport terminal you walked in before Stansted, you looked up at the ceiling. It was all pipes, whirring machinery, solid ceiling. We put all that below the concourse and we opened up the roof to the sky, to the sun. And we opened up views, so we made an analog experience in a digital world. You could see the aircraft, you move towards the aircraft. That was revolutionary. Hong Kong, Beijing, the Mexico, they're all kind of evolutionary. Mexico probably is another revolutionary move because we increase the spans and we take away the flat roof and the vertical walls and we make one continuous kind of flowing membrane. And that's quite revolutionary because a typical span between columns in an airport pre-Mexico is probably 36 meters. Now we're 100, 170 meters.
What enables that now? I think people will be sort of scrambling to say, what forces and technology have allowed you to work with those types of spans?
I think
now?
It's the development of engineering skills, of being able to do many calculations, explore many options more quickly than in an analog past. And I think it's in the nature of design that you make from time to time revolutionary moves. But as a designer, then you're building on those moves. You're refining them. So it's a series of constant explorations and transfers of technology. Our work with the European Space Agency, for example, recently, the knowledge from that has enabled us to propose drone ports using drone technology, an emerging technology normally associated with, you know, violence and war, in this case for humanitarian delivery of vital medical supplies across Africa, because the infrastructure can't physically keep up with the growth. So in 2050, something like 1 in 4 of the global population will be African, and the population will double between now and 2050. It's 1.1 billion now, it will be 2.2 billion. And 1/3 of Africa is only 1/3 is within a so-called all-season road. And if you take an all-season road, it can be quite a quagmire. So I think that in that sense, the world of design is fascinating. You're getting major initiatives which are coming from these emerging economies and which will feed back also into our more established economies. But the question is, do we learn from that?
Well, you talk about this great march of humanity, looking at the African continent, but also, you know, the emerging economies right now, and Mexico being, you know, a fine example. I think your Mexico City project is amazing that this happens on the doorstep of the U.S. when all of us are wondering, you know, when someone is going to get the memo that, yeah, maybe 3 or 4 U.S. cities need a proper hub as well, a proper hub to serve the world. And I think it's politically fascinating that the Mexicans are doing this. But as a side note, do you think that when we look at sort of lessons learned and what has to occur in cities, you know, oftentimes everyone wants to talk about placemaking today. And so we erect a couple of towers, we put sort of plate glass at street level, and there's no interaction with the street. But I think about a project in New York when you worked with the Hearsts, and that tower where there was obviously something very interesting happening on top of something that was existing as well. And I'm wondering if what considerations went into that, because I think that's a very interesting project where it still relates on a very very humane level, but also a very handsome level at street level. But then also what happens above is also a delight.
It's quite interesting. I mean, I was told there were certain things you could and could not do in New York. And one of them was so-called facadism, which when I asked about that, seemed to challenge every instinct that we had as designers, which was to bring life to the base of the building and to hollow it out so it became the equivalent of an internal piazza, and to keep shops and activities at the sidewalk pavement level. And we succeeded in doing that. And I think that it's proved to be a success in the public domain and also in the inner kind of private domain, where all these different magazines, which were little empires unto themselves, still retained that individuality, each having their own floor. But the collective at the base of the building is the common dining room, snacks, coffee, meeting, exhibitions, auditorium, and so on. But that is in the part conversion of a historic building, 1928 Art Deco, which was always going to have a tower, but it was never realized until we won the competition for that project. Interestingly, here in London, we're doing the same thing with Bloomberg, and on a site which was absolutely monolithic previously, we now make it quite porous, permeable. So we extend the line of Watling Street, the old Roman street, and that becomes an arcade in the tradition of past tradition of arcades. And the whole base of the building is alive with shops, bars, galleries, restaurants. So we are, in this instance, I mean, seeking to rediscover the qualities of the city, where normally, if you walk at pavement level, it's a blank facade. It's kind of hostile. It's not inviting. And handling security by involving artists. So, for example, Christina Iglesias is doing water features, which are actually the barriers, the security barriers. And if you look around Parliament and you see how horrific security can actually, how intrusive it can be in the public domain. So seeking ways of humanizing those realities of security. So a lot of lessons of the traditional city being fed back. I'm often asked, you know, what are the most important things that you might have done in London? Everybody expects it might be the British Museum, and for very good reasons, or you know, this building or that building. I'd say it was probably Trafalgar Square and the Millennium Bridge, because they brought a new quality of urban life back to the city.
Lord Foster there, in discussion with Monocle's editorial director, Tyler Brulé, and you can listen out, keep an eye and an ear for lots more highlights from the first 10 years on air for Monocle 24. You're listening to The Briefing. We are talking art after this. Past midday here in London. Finally on the programme, Frieze Art Fair 2021 is launching in London this week. Monocle's Chiara Remella has already made her way to the preview of this great contemporary art fair and joins us now live from Regent's Park. It's only a few hundred yards away, and that's where the fair is taking place. Hello, Chiara, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Yes, I made the incredible journey 10 minutes down the road by walking here this morning. But I've got to say, the atmosphere is really worth the long journey I took. And it's really impressive. There is a real buzz in the air and lots of people who are enthusiastically kind of embracing outside the tent and recognizing and themselves, each other in the tent. And I think the art on the walls is also helping set the mood for this year's edition. Obviously, it's the return of the physical format after a hiatus last year when very few things kind of happened physically and most of it was digital. And so having a lot of colourful art on the walls, much as it is like a bit of a cheap trick, is actually really helping kind of lift the spirit. This is not to say that there is no kind of socially committed art on display, and we'll get onto that later on. But I think overall, the mood is really quite enthusiastic and jubilant here.
Well, yeah, and before we talk a bit about the works, because I was talking to our Robert Bound earlier, and he was talking about there's always this resurgence of painting often after periods of upheaval. So we'll come to that and these splashes of colour you've alluded to. But just in terms of the mood, I think we spoke, didn't we, around the time of Art Basel. Are there any similarities or differences in terms either of the makeup of the fair, but also just the mood around it from just in those few short weeks?
Yeah, it's interesting, right, the difference that a few weeks make. I mean, Frieze is always the place where people come to, like, dress up and dress extravagantly, and it's always a little bit more kind of loose around the edges than Basel is, for quite obvious reasons. But also, I mean, earlier last month I went to Basel, and obviously there was an energy in the air, but I feel like Basel was a lot more about commerce still. And much as it was obviously a very international event, because it always is, there is a very kind of Middle European presence there. Here we're seeing today galleries from Beirut, from Athens, some Tokyo galleries, which I was actually really surprised to see. I recognized Takaishi, who I interviewed in Tokyo a few years ago, in person again, which I think is quite remarkable, because a lot of the Asian galleries who did go to Basel a few weeks ago perhaps didn't really send any staff or just use the European staff. There is a sense of commitment on the ground here. There is a sense of also different art markets that are kind of emerging. You know, you've got Romanian galleries, as I said, Greek galleries. So there's a bit of more of a distribution. In saying that, obviously, when you walk through the door, it's kind of reassuring to see the Grand Dame and the kind of the big players of London, of the London scene, just having their massive big booths at the entrance. You know where you stand with Gagosian, and they're there just to provide a kind of entry kind of tableau for people to just do all the meeting and greeting amongst their walls. And I think that's a power play that's kind of here to stay.
Yeah, absolutely. Big players, big names, big works. Chiara, let's talk a little bit about these splashes of colour that you mentioned already. I guess people, you know, when they get back together, they want to go big, go bold, or go home. And that's certainly what's happened. Anything caught your eye in particular?
Well, I'm standing just in front of Sfar Samla from Beirut, and they've got this amazing tent with Arabic written on it. It's kind of a calming work, at a space of intimacy, which I think is very evocative in the context of what's obviously happened in Beirut in the last year plus. As you said, and as Rob said, obviously, it's interesting to see a lot of painting on the walls. Normally people tend to see that as a sign that the market's kind of been a bit cautious, because painting does sell a bit easier than, you know, large installations. And it's relatively a sign of conservatism, if you will. In saying that, these paintings are no kind of easy kind of figurative things. There's a lot of daring work on display here. A few installations, not that many sculptures, but I still think that if you come, you will be wowed. It doesn't feel like a conservative show to me, for sure.
And very briefly, Chiara, just finally, I read your Monocle Minute, I think this very morning, about the fair, looking at some other iterations, some other expansions, Cork Street opening, of course. Again, what do we make of that? Is that further evidence of their broader confidence, just an enthusiasm to get back out into the world? Tell us a bit about that.
Well, I think that obviously when you come back, you have to come back with something added, because otherwise, you know, you have to show that you've used this time to do something about yourself and not just come back exactly as you were before. In saying that, you know, a lot of fairs have used this time to develop more digital platforms. They're kind of expanding in that realm. And much as obviously that is a consideration for everyone here as well, particularly linked to also the climate impact of fairs, which Frieze is very, very interested in. Victoria Siddle founded the Gallery Climate Coalition, which is particularly dedicated to curbing the climate impact of fairs, which is very much high on top of the agenda. They also opened this new space in Cork Street, which last year actually was used for performances during this kind of muted edition of Frieze. And this year it's been rented out as a pop-up space for galleries that might want a bit more space, a bit more room, to show their stuff year-round, also not just around Frieze Week. I think it's interesting because a lot of smaller fairs utilize this model of kind of splintering away and lots of galleries doing shows in the city and not necessarily centralized around a central event. For Frieze to occupy that space, for them to become the host, also outside the tent, to show that they've learned and they're now not willing to kind of lose the prominence that they have for the event to splinter off, but that they want to be at the centre of it still.
Absolutely. Chiara, thanks very much for bringing us up to speed. That was Monocle's culture editor, Chiara Remella, reporting live from London's Frieze Art Fair, just around the corner. That's all for this edition of The Briefing, which was produced by Marco Sippi. Our researcher was Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, our studio manager, Louis Allen. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. If you want to hear more from me and from Chiara and a host of other Monocle editors, you can still join us tomorrow for a special Monocle Media Summit, in part to celebrate 10 years on air for Monocle 24. Do head to our website, monocle.com, to find out more about the last few tickets available. I'm Tom Edwards. That is your Wednesday Briefing. Thank you very much for tuning in.